Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Tom Dreesen's life is equal parts comedy and philanthropy. He excels at both and has created an extraordinary legacy in both arenas. Dreesen has made over 500 appearances on national television as a stand-up comedian, including more than 60 appearances on The Tonight Show. He was a favorite guest of David Letterman and frequently hosted the show in Letterman's absence. For 14 years, he toured cross-country and opened for my hero, Frank Sinatra, and has appeared countless times in Las Vegas, Tahoe, Reno, and Atlantic City with artists like Smokey Robinson, Liza Minnelli, Natalie Cole, and Sammy Davis Jr. Tom has acted in numerous television shows, from Columbo to Murder, She Wrote, and appeared in motion pictures including Man on the Moon and Spaceballs. He has recorded comedy albums, started his own TV comedy special, Dreesen Street, and hosted a late-night talk show in Chicago, Nighttime, starring Tom Dreesen. He appeared to rave reviews around the country in his one-man show, An Evening of Laughter and Memories of Sinatra. Dreesen's comic style is down-to-earth, warm, and unpretentious. Daily Variety called him a thorough pro, one of the most respected family comedians of our time. Frank Sinatra, who called himself a saloon singer, characterized Dreesen as a saloon comedian. "We're a couple of neighborhood kind of guys," said Sinatra. Tom Dreesen's hometown of Harvey, Illinois, named a street after him, and he was also a 2000 recipient of the Ellis Island Medal of Honor. Please welcome American actor and stand-up comedian Tom Dreesen to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Tom.
Ray, my career isn't as long as that introduction. That
sure was
nice.
Well, you know what? There was a lot more, but I couldn't fit it in.
Oh, that's very nice. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. When did you start touring with Sinatra? I saw Frank four times. Probably the best shows I've ever seen in my life, and I've been to a lot of shows. I saw him in Vegas with Freddie Roman, Atlantic City with Charlie Callis. I saw him in Maryland at the Capitol Center with Jan Murray, and I don't remember who was with him in the Kennedy Center, but these were all like, you know, late 70s, early 80s. When did you start?
I started touring with Frank in 82.
82.
Until the last song he ever sang. You know, I was with him for 14 years in 45, 50 cities a year.
Right.
Until the very last song he sang, which, by the way, for trivia, do you know what the last song he ever sang on stage is?
It wasn't My Way, was it?
No, The Best Is Yet to Come.
Oh, okay.
And what happened was that night, you know, he hadn't worked in like 4 or 5 months, and no one even knew if he was ever going to sing again, you know, because his health wasn't great.
Right.
But that night, it was for the Barbara Sinatra Children's Center at the Marriott Desert Springs in Palm Desert. in California, and he was supposed to sing three songs. I did the 20 minutes of stand-up comedy, and then he came out to do three songs, and the audience couldn't get enough of him that night. They kept giving him a standing ovation after standing ovation, and so he sang the three songs, and he sang the fourth song and the fifth song, and finally, he sang one more song, "The Best Is Yet to Come," and the audience just stood and cheered, and that was the last song he ever sang, and that's what's on his tombstone, "The Best Is Yet to Come," Francis Albert Sinatra. Yeah.
You know, I saw his tombstone. It's very modest. I mean, you would have thought a man in his stature would have like a huge mausoleum or something. It's very simple.
That's what he wanted, too. In fact, he wanted a simple funeral. Right. He told me when I toured with Sammy Davis for 3 years in my career before I ever toured with Frank. And when we went to Sammy's funeral, I went with Frank, and it was really big. It was like 2,500 people, and you know, at Forest Lawn and everything. And Frank said, limo going back to the house, he's saying, "I don't want that. It was too theatrical. When I die, I just want something simple." And I jokingly said to him that night, I said, "You know, Frank, when you die, they should have," and I said, "I hope it's 100 years from now, but I said, they should have your funeral at like 2:45 in the morning."
Yep.
and all your buddies with a little Jack Daniels, you know, toast you, and at 2:45 in the morning, because from the song "One for My Baby," you know, it's 2:45, there's no one in the place
sure.
except you. And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, you make that happen, Tommy." I said, "Oh, yeah, sure. I'm going to tell your family that funeral at 2:45 in the morning. They'll dig another grave right alongside yours, and they'll put me in it, you know."
I remember a Mary Tyler Moore show where Lou Grant says, "You know, when I die, just stick me in a trash can in the corner and put my hat on my head." That, you know?
Yeah, everybody always has those how they want to go, and then also, you know, the Irish, I'm Irish Italian.
Right.
It makes you a mean drunk is all it makes you. But when I was an altar boy, you know, I used to serve mass at Irish funerals and at Italian funerals. But the Irish always fantasize about the funeral and how they think it's going to be, and, you know, lines around the block and, you know, all the weeping and all that kind of stuff. In fact, if you didn't cry at an Irish funeral, you'd rent people to cry, you know.
I got a thing about Irish priests. I think they are so cool, and I'm just, you know, ready to spill my guts to these guys because they're awesome. You know, they're like the real deal. You know.
Yeah, I was an altar boy and you know and all that stuff, and our priests in those days, and with all the controversy going on today with the priests, and of course, and it's some terrible things that have happened. But I never met a priest like that ever. And I was an altar boy. Our priests were Irish, and you know, and Jesuits and pretty tough guys, you know.
Right.
I always thought that you became a Jesuit because you couldn't get a title shot. You know? So you went into the priesthood, you know.
like you, I went to Catholic school in high school and then went back to public school, and that was a hell of a change, man. You went from a real strict environment to, you know, public schools, and, you know, I really goofed off after that.
Yeah, the same thing happened to me. I went to Catholic grade school, but then went to a public high school, and it was like night and day. And to be perfectly honest, I was head and shoulders above my classmates at that time, because Catholic schools were so strict that you went there to learn, and they went there to teach, and no one broke that up, you know. And so, you know, we were learning, like, algebra in fourth and fifth grade, you know, things like that. So they were, I have to say, they were great educators, that's for sure.
They were. I was in an all-boys school, too. You know, our big thing was going to the dances with the all-girls school. You know, that was our big look.
And you know, the nuns, way back in the day, used to say that they didn't want white sheets at the dinners with the in grade school, even because the sheets for the tablecloth, because it reminded, I mean, white tablecloth, because it reminded the boys of sheets or something like that. So it had those, you know, but you can't wear patent leather shoes because boys could look down and see up your dress. And one of my earlier Tonight shows, I talked about that. I said, you know, but Beverly Capilillo wore patent leather shoes and patent leather underwear. Whenever you look down, all you'd see is your face.
You had a joke about a nun, too. I remember about them being bullies.
Oh, yeah. Well, the joke I did was, bullies, that's very important. you know, discussing that about the problems with bullies in the playground and all that stuff. It's because everybody had bullies. I saw like a neighborhood I grew up and we had bullies, and there was a group that you didn't, if you looked at them cross-eyed, they'd just beat the hell out of you.
Right.
They were black and white, and we called them nuns.
Yeah, exactly.
That was always the joke, you know.
Yep, my
nuns, I was very close to them, and I can name them all now.
Really?
I had eight nuns, and I can name them, and I still remember them to this day. Sister Catherine Margaret, Sister Margareta, Sister Bernadette Mary, Sister Marie Andre, Sister Anne Cecile, Sister Bertolda, Sister Thomasita, and Sister Madonna Treese. And I'll put those eight nuns up against any SWAT team anywhere in America.
That's funny. I always remember Cheech and Chong with Sister Mary Elephant. That was a good one, too.
Oh, yeah. But they were great educators.
And
I loved them all. They're all past now.
Yeah.
And, because I'm getting older, you know, obviously. But they, even when I toured with Sinatra, sometimes the nuns would come to the show, and I would bring them backstage and introduce them to Frank, and he was always so gracious with them, mm-hmm. and always so nice with them, and ask them 100 questions about me as a student and all that stuff, you know. But they were great educators and great ladies, and I respect them greatly for all they did for me when I was growing up, you know.
Yeah, yeah. They made my wife, she was left-handed, and they made her right-handed because they didn't have any left-handed desks. They were tough.
You know, by the way, so that you know what the origin of that, and people who are listening to you right now probably what you're talking about, but what they used to do years ago, if you were left-handed, supposedly that was considered like the devil, left-handed. So they would tie your left hand to the side of the desk. They would, like a little, and teach you to read right-handed. You know, so many antiquated things that were being done in those days, you know, when I look back, you know. But the thing that I did when I look back that I loved is that we said the Pledge of Allegiance every morning.
Exactly.
There was a flag in every classroom. We said the Pledge of Allegiance, and we said morning prayers.
Right.
And I bring that up because one time with Frank Sinatra, we were working at Nassau Memorial Coliseum,
mm-hmm.
and waiting for the audience to get in and everything. There were, in Frank's dressing room, there was like a American flag on a pole in the corner. And Frank said to me, "Did you ever, when you were growing up, Tommy, did you say the Pledge of Allegiance?" And I said, "Yes, every morning." He said, "Yeah, we did too,"
right.
in Hoboken. He was telling me about that. And I jokingly said to him, Jilly Rizzo was
right.
Frank's bodyguard, was
sure.
standing there, and I said to Frank, I said, "You know, the only thing I could didn't understand about the Pledge of Allegiance was who was that guy, Richard Stans."
Uh-huh.
I said, "You know, to the Republic for Richard Stans." You know, and Frank laughed, and I laughed, and Jilly said to me, "Yeah, who was that guy?" You know, and
<That's>
and we realized he wasn't joking. You know.
Did Frank make you stay up into the wee hours like he did with a lot of people?
No question about it.
Really?
I do the one-man show now, An Evening of Laughter and Memories of Sinatra. It's a 90-minute show.
Right.
And it's stand-up comedy, but then I segue over to a bar, and I start telling stories, and pictures come on the screen authenticating the stories that I'm telling, as well as film of Frank and I together. You know, and I go from, from the little boy from the south side of Chicago hearing Sinatra on the jukebox to one day carrying his coffin out of a church in Beverly Hills, California. But I do talk a lot about, he never went to bed till the sun came up.
Yep.
And whether we were on the road or off the road, at home, when the sun came up, Frank went to bed, and he wanted you to hang with him, you know, and I did, and which was fun for about 10 years, and then you start to want to get some sleep every now and then, you know, but he was nocturnal, and so that's why we stayed up till the wee hours of the morning, you know, all the time.
Yeah, I stay up until the wee hours, but I don't drink until the wee hours. Big difference. I don't know how he did it.
I quit years ago, and it would get on, and sometimes I'd get like iced tea, so it looked like a cocktail.
Right.
You know, or sometimes I would get like Coke with a straw and a glass of, so it looked like rum and Coke, you know.
Yeah.
So he'd think I was drinking right alongside of him, you know.
You know what I miss? Growing up, guys like Dean Martin, Sammy Davis, Sinatra, these guys were cool. And they weren't young guys, you know, they were middle age and whatever. And we looked up to these guys and they were hip and we wanted to be like them, you know? Things have really changed since those times. It's like if you're older now, you're like the enemy or something, you know?
Well, you know, they Frank was cool before cool was cool. You know, I remember one time a guy named his last name was Green. I'm just blanking. You know, he wrote a great, Bob Green. He went to see Frank when Frank was in his 50s.
Right.
And he thought it was this, he got a chance to see him, somebody gave him a couple of tickets, and it was at the Fountain Blue down in, Miami.
Right.
And he said when he walked out of it, he thought, wow, it's cool to be 50, 55.
That's right.
Frank made it look cool, you know.
Yeah.
But the other thing too is, first of all, when you go to Frank, Sammy, and Dean, you know, they weren't old. They didn't seem like they're old. And they all were like what Frank Sinatra's song was, My Way.
Mm-hmm.
They did it their way.
Right.
You know, these were three enormous talents, incredible talents. But they lived life to the max.
Yeah.
You know, and vicariously, people around the country wanted, they lived through Frank and Sammy and Dean. You know what I mean? When I was a kid shining shoes in all the bars in the south side of Chicago with steel mills and factories where I lived at a suburb called Harvey, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And, Frank was on every jukebox there and the guys would sit and talk about him, you know, fantasize. See, what would it be like flying with Frank all over the world and doing it their way, the way he lived life to its fullest, you know.
Yeah, his movies, same thing, Dean Martin, the Matt Helm movies, he was so cool, you know, hanging out with Ann Margaret, who is my all-time favorite. I got to meet her here in Sarasota and got to hug her and everything, and it was my birthday, and I told my wife, why couldn't I kiss her? Why didn't you tell her to kiss me? It was my birthday, you know? Because she kissed Tom Jones and Henry Winkler and all these people, and I had my shot, but she didn't remind me to go up and kiss Ann Margaret, so...
Now, you mentioned Sarasota. One of the stories I told at Frank's funeral, you know, was that, you know, I told the funeral, I spoke at the funeral, I said, all of you stayed up with Frank, you know, like I had to, like all of you friends know that he never went to bed till the sun came up. I said, one time we flew down to Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
We were going to do 1 week at the Sunrise Theater.
Yep.
But first we were going to do a one-nighter in Daytona, a one-nighter in Fort Myer, and a one-nighter in Sarasota.
Okay.
And so we'd fly out of Fort Lauderdale each night to do these one-nighters. And one night we flew flew back from Sarasota and hung out till like dawn, which we did every night. But the point I was going to make is the first night we got there, we had that night off. And so Frank, you know, the moment the jet landed, the squad cars and limousines rushed us to the hotel, and Frank went straight into the lounge.
Mm-hmm.
And I snuck out, and I went up to my room thinking, good, I'll get up early in the morning and be able to play golf.
Right.
And I was in my room 5 minutes, I heard a pounding on the door, and it was a big red-headed Dalman. I opened the door, he looked like a linebacker from the Miami Dolphins. He had a crew cut, you know. And he said, Mr. Dreesen, Mr. Sinatra wants you downstairs in the lounge. And I reached my pocket, I tried to give him $20. I said, can you tell him you couldn't find me? He said, Mr. Sinatra gave me $100 to tell you he wants you downstairs in the lounge.
That's great.
And I said, oh, man. He said, if you resist, and I had to drag you down there, he'd give me $200. So I knew I was going. This guy was going to put me in a headlock.
That's funny.
I went downstairs, and Frank said, hey, let's pay Pally, let's have some fun. And sure enough, we stayed up till dawn again, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, he liked the company, man. I don't blame him.
You know, I'm from Chicago, and I'm a hangout guy. I like to hang out.
Right.
Comedians, for the most part, are hangout guys.
Sure.
After the shows, you like to hang out.
Right.
And there's women that like it, you know, what you call hangout people, hangout guys and girls. And when somebody asked me one time to describe what is a great hangout guy or girl, it's someone who could tell the same story 500 times, and they would laugh just as much as they did the first time they heard the story. And they'd love hanging out and telling stories, and if somebody new joined the group, we were real happy, you know, because we'd say, hey, tell Ray about that night that you and Frank did or something, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's just people who like to sit around, reminisce, and tell funny stories, you know.
What do you remember most? I'm going to give you the three guys. What do you remember most about Frank, Dean, and Sammy?
Individually or as a group?
Individually.
As a group, what I remember about mm-hmm. them is how much they loved performing for you.
Right.
How much they loved show business. You know, how much they loved one another. And the charisma they had on stage, you know. There's never been anybody like that before. you know, no William Morris agency or no agency put those three guys together.
Mm-hmm.
They got together because they really truly loved one another in the beginning.
Right.
And they truly loved performing with one another. You know, they were just the charisma they had on stage together and the love they had for performing for you. Individually, you know, I mean, Dean, I played golf with Dean and I'm still dear friends with his children.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean was the kind of guy that, a couple of things. Number one, he wouldn't say anything all day long, and then he'd say one line, and you'd fall on the floor laughing. It would be the best observation of the day or something. He just had a wit about him. He was a great comedian, even though people think of him always as a singer.
Right.
He had great comedic skills.
Right.
The other thing is, when you talk about, they always talk about Frank being a tough guy or fighting. Dean was the tough guy.
Really?
He was tougher than any of those guys. He boxed under the name of Kid Crescetti,
uh-huh.
Growing up in Steubenville, Ohio. He was a tough guy. He had big hands and he didn't take a whole lot of guff from anybody,
mm-hmm.
from anybody, even the mob guys. And it's in a book a man named Romer wrote. He was a former FBI guy and did a lot of wiretapping and stuff like that. But he talked about how Johnny Rosselli, a mob guy down in Miami, reached over Dean's shoulder to take one of his shrimp from his shrimp cocktail, and Dean slapped his hand and told him, "I don't like people fooling with my food," you know.
Yeah.
And Rosselli later in a wiretap said he wanted to whack Dean, you know.
Oh, jeez.
But that's what I remember about Dean. I loved Dean. He was a good guy,
yeah.
a good athlete, and a good friend. The Sammy had more show business acumen in his baby finger than most people have in their whole body.
I agree.
The years I took with him, I'd sit in the wings and watch him night after night. Sammy could sing as good as anybody out there.
Mm-hmm.
Frank said he never heard Sammy hit a clinker.
Right.
Frank would hit a clinker once in a while. Sammy just had this great voice. He also, not only was a great singer, he could dance as good as anybody out there. He could do comedy as good as anybody out there.
Mm-hmm.
He could do impressions better than almost anybody out there. He could play piano, he could play the drums, he could play the trumpet. You know, he was a parade.
Yep.
There was nothing Sammy couldn't do on stage. And the years I toured with him, he was incredibly generous to me.
Yeah.
And became a great friend. And then, of course, Frank, you know, what I remember, aside from him being the greatest pop singer of all time,
right.
You forget what a brilliant actor he was.
That's right.
He won the Academy Award. He never took an acting lesson. One night I was sitting with Frank at his compound down in Rancho Mirage, and all the women had gone to bed. There was Gregory Peck, Kirk Douglas, Clint Eastwood, Robert Wagner, Frank, and I. And they were all talking about film and acting, and I couldn't, I just was like a fly on the wall. I was just fascinated by their conversations. But what I was really noticing was how these great actors were showing such great reverence to Frank. And I was just curious, and I said to him, "Frank, who'd you study with? Who'd you study acting with?" And Gregory Peck grabbed my arm hard, and he said, "Acting lessons would have ruined him."
Mm-hmm.
He was a diamond in the rough you didn't fool with.
Yeah.
So when you gave Frank Sinatra a song, to him it was a script. What did the writer feel when the writer took pen in hand? Frank would immerse himself in that lyric and become that lonely guy in the bar.
Right.
Which woman left him, and he's never going to find love again.
Yep.
And you felt that pain and the joy of the songs, you know, "Come Fly With Me."
Yep.
And the other thing is just this incredible generosity.
Yeah.
Things you'll never know about, because he didn't want anybody to know
exactly.
about. Exactly. But he was a incredibly generous person and a complex man, to say the least, you know, very complex, you know.
Yeah, I saw a YouTube video about, it was a tour about his, was it in Palm Springs, his house with the layout. It was, you know, humongous. It had, you know, I think he got married there as well. I'm not sure, but was that in Palm Springs?
The compound, right.
Yeah.
When you went inside, they had a security office and security guards in there.
Right.
And when they opened the gate, you know, when you come in, they'd open up the gate. It was a sliding wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd come in, and then on your right was where all of his cars were in the garage. And
yeah.
then straight ahead was a caboose. But in the caboose, there was a barber chair and a massage table and all that kind of stuff. And next to that was a little building that had like a couple $1 million worth of electric trains.
That was awesome.
He
I saw that.
Train that there ever was in the world on the walls. You know, he'd have them on all the walls. And in the middle, a center table, he had like 7 trains that would be going from the East Coast to the West Coast.
Right.
And he would operate them. He'd put on a little engineer's hat and, you know, woo, and you know, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the tennis courts and the swimming pool. But in his main house, but along the wall, the border of it was on this 16th hole of Tamarisk.
Right.
Along the perimeter were bungalows, and they were named after his songs, New York, New York, Strangers in the Night, Tender Trap, My Way, and that's where the house guests stayed, you know.
Yeah, his train collection was phenomenal. I saw that, and, you know, I guess they're still there. Are they keeping it? Yeah.
Yeah, the guy who bought the house from him originally was a guy who owns Canadian Club.
Right.
You know, he had another home in Palm Springs years before that, that he had a studio in that he used to record in,
mm-hmm.
but the compound was where he stayed the most of his life, and that's where I stayed all the time. When I'd go down there six times a year and just stay in the compound when I was off the road, you know, because I just loved being with him.
Yeah.
In the beginning, Frank Sinatra was like, he was the boss, without a doubt.
Yep.
It's all about the show, and the show was important, and everybody better know their job, because he knew your job. He knew what everybody was supposed to do, and so and the show was important, mm-hmm. so he was the boss. As time went by, he became a friend, like mm-hmm. a pal, and then toward the end of his life, he was more like a father to me.
And that's
I miss
so
him every
cool.
day.
So cool. You know, I interview a lot of legendary rock stars on my show, and Frank Sinatra was definitely the original rock star, you know? Because, you know, the way he started and everything, and with Bobby Soxers, and he was the original. He really was.
Well, yeah, I think that we're the original where people swooned. I heard that Rudolph Valentino was like that, but he wasn't a singer.
No.
He was like a dancer, but I heard women would literally faint when they saw Rudolph Valentino. I read that.
Huh.
You know, I never, of course, it was way before my time. But Frank, in the beginning, you know, and then later, of course, the Beatles and all those other, and Elvis and everything, but originally it was Frank.
It was Frank.
But think about this. How many people in show business, you'll say to someone, and you know, he was a star for 10 years, or he sold out shows for 10 years, or they had hit records.
Yep.
How many people, you know, for 60 years was a star?
Nobody.
Frank Sinatra, at age 78, sold out in Japan.
That's right.
He sold out in Moscow. He sold out in Argentina. He sold out in Rio de Janeiro.
Yep.
How many American artists, you know, sold out overseas? You know, this is a man when he was 78 doing that. You know, he transcended show business. He was larger than life. Forget about his great singing skills, because arguably he was the greatest pop singer of all time.
Yep.
But I told you about his acting skills,
mm-hmm.
where he won the Academy Award. He danced with Gene Kelly.
I know.
For God's sake. He danced with
amazing.
Gene Kelly in movies.
Amazing.
You know, he was larger than life. And then also always the mystique was about the mob. You know, I can go right now and give a talk about Frank Sinatra if I did or did my one-man show
mm-hmm.
and for an hour and a half. And if I afterward had a Q&A, the first question asked of me was Frank Sinatra in the mafia? You know, of all the things that this man accomplished,
right.
they'll end up asking that question, and I always have to say the truth. No, he was not. Of course not. But did he know those guys? Of course he did.
Sure.
When he started out in the show business, as when I started out, even though it was years after him, those guys owned those places. They
right.
owned Las Vegas. They owned the clubs all over the country.
Right.
So did you know them? Of course you knew them. You worked for them.
Yeah.
You know, did you have your picture taken with them? Of course you did. You had your picture taken with them. You know, but he told me, Frank Sinatra told me, that he rued the day that he ever made friends with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 20 years of his life, he said he rued the day, he said, because they won't get out of your life. You know, you'll do, one of them will do a favor for you, and then you'll repay that. And 20 years later, the son will come along and say, my dad did a favor, so you repay that.
Yeah.
And 20 more years, and the grandson says, you know, my grandfather, you know, and he said, they won't get out of your life, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I knew a few mob guys, too. I mean, my dad grew up in Brooklyn in Bensonhurst, and, you know, there was the Jewish side and the Italian side, and he told me about all these guys, you know, like Johnny the Babe and this and that. And as I grew up, they had them at, you know, they were friends of my uncle's, you know, and I saw them at bar mitzvahs, and my dad would say, you see that guy over there with the big hand? Just go say hello to him, you know, say hi to him, you know, that's all. Just say hi to him and come back, you know. But, you know, it's no biggie.
That, by the way, that, where I grew up, they were at every funeral, they were at every communion, they were at every wedding, you know, in the Italian neighborhoods.
Right.
You know, but going back to Dean gave me the best advice. I was working with Dean one time, and we were talking about this. He said, Tommy, be respectful, but keep them at arm's length.
Right. Exactly.
Keep them at arm's length. Don't ever let them do a favor for you if you can help it.
Yep.
know, just say, no, I'm fine. No, I'm fine. Do you need any money? No, I'm fine.
Right.
Anyway, you know, and that was Dean's advice. He said, keep an arm's length.
Exactly.
Know?
Yep. Couple of things. You had a heckler that was actually kind of a mob guy. You said that it's a cool story. You were up on stage and the guy was like on the front row and he kept saying things like you suck with his girlfriend. And you waited till after the show. Do you know what I'm talking about? To give it back to him?
Is that when I think it was when I was working at the Riviera.
Riviera, right.
A wise guy down front.
Right.
That's when they wore the beads and the chains around the neck and all that. Yeah, that's a story. Where did you hear that story at? It's interesting. I must have told it somewhere.
Probably. YouTube's got everything.
Pardon me?
YouTube has everything. You go on YouTube, there's so much information on you on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, and I think this was a story you're talking about that I had to check. First of all, when I teach young comedians, mm-hmm. if you're in a room with 85 people, small crowd,
right.
and somebody's heckling you, you've got to respond.
Right.
The audience heard it, and they know what he said, and I teach them how to deal with the heckler, how to give them so much rope that they end up hanging themselves.
Yep.
It qualify your heckler. It might be just a guy having a good time, and he's not mean or trying to heckle you. He just wants to be a part of it. And so you take some time with them, and in a small room, everything he says, the audience heard it, so you can respond. But in a big room, if there's 2,000 people or 3,000 people, or if it's a 20,000 seater, like when I was working Franken Place, I wouldn't even deal with the guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to waste the whole show for
sure.
some jerk down front,
yep.
you know, that no one else can hear, but just the people around them. But if you're in a small room and the people heard him, then you've got to react to it. Now, if you're going to deal with a guy in a room of 2,500 seats or more, then whatever he says, you have to repeat back through the microphone. Because if you repeat it back through the microphone, then the audience hears what he said. So, otherwise, if you just respond to the guy, they didn't even know what the guy said. So it makes no sense for you to not let the audience in on it.
Right.
So I would tell them to keep repeating what he says through the microphone. Two things. One, it gives the audience a chance to qualify him, and it gives you a chance to think of a funny response, you know. So, but this particular night, I had about 2,500 people in the room, and this guy was... Every time I was working a little bit stage left and a little bit stage right, every time I got near his table down front, he had three girls with him, and he was leaning way back in the chair. And he says to the girls were laughing, the audience was great. He said to them when I got in front of him, he said, you like this guy? This guy sucks.
Right.
So I looked at him, but I just worked the stage left again. And every time I got near him, he'd say, I can't believe you like this guy. This guy sucks. And the girls are saying, oh, Tony, stop it. No, this guy sucks. So I just kept working because the rest of the audience didn't hear that. And now I finally got to the end of the show. What you do in those days, you'd take your bow, good night, everybody, and you'd walk off stage, and they'd call you back out. Tommy Gleason, take a bow. You come back out. And what I did was, as I took bows, I went back, went in the wings. They said, Tommy Gleason, come back and take another bow. I went right in front of this table, and I bowed, and I said to the girls, you like this guy? This guy sucks. And I waved goodbye to the audience, and I walked off. Well, he couldn't. Because if I would have let him in the act, and that's what he really wanted,
exactly.
then I would have had to deal with him the whole show.
Right.
You know, so it was best to ignore him, and that made it even worse for him at that time. You know?
That's funny. That's great. You are legendary also for the Amo joke.
That's one of the strangest stories that has ever been told.
In my lifetime,
as you pointed out, I did 61 appearances on The Tonight Show, and I did, you know, other Dinah Shore, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, Johnny Carson, Midnight Special, Rock Concert, Soul Train, American Bandstand. I'm the only white comedian ever to do Soul Train because I have an album out in front of an all-black audience called That White Boy's Crazy, you know. But I've written maybe a 1,000 jokes. I don't know how many jokes I've written. One of the dumbest jokes I ever wrote wasn't dumb, but it segued to another joke. I was talking about a tough guy in my neighborhood, and there were, you know, guys in my neighborhood that they used the word that no one else used in the other neighborhood. Amo, A-H-M-O,
right.
Amo, kick your butt. You know. Now, that set up to another joke. Now, I did that on the Dean Martin roast years ago.
Yep.
They were roasting Grizzly Adams.
Right.
And
Dan Haggerty.
Dan Haggerty from Grizzly Adams.
Right.
You know, and that was one that roast. And I was talking about doing something about he's from the country and they think they're so tough. I'm from the city. We use a line in the city they didn't use in the country. Amo, AHMO, Amo, kick yo. But now Dean and everybody laughed. They thought it was funny. Now, unbeknownst to me, and I never knew this, there's a coach down in Texas. Now, this was down around, I guess, in the 80s, maybe 80. No, maybe it was the late 70s. In the late 70s, because I was doing the Dean Moms. I think it was 78, 79. Anyhow, nonetheless, there was a coach down in Texas, in Wylie, Texas. And his high school was, they beat everybody, and they were going into the state of Texas high school football championship. And he was going to play a team called Breckenridge, who was blowing everybody out by 20 and 25 points. He knew his team, this little high school's team, he knew they couldn't beat this team. But he was watching the Dean Montrose that night. He heard me do that line. He went in on Monday. They were going to play the following Sunday. And he went in on Monday or following Saturday. I'm saying, he went in on Monday and he told the team, AMO. That's our battle cry. A-H-M-O. AMO. When you kneel down in front of that guy, you just think, AMO. Kick your butt. AMO. And they broke huddle. They'd go, AMO. And then they'd all yell, AMO. And then they didn't line up in AMO. Anyhow, they win the game with like 6 seconds to go. They win the game. The cheerleaders run back to Wylie, to the downtown, and they write AMO on all the store windows and all that stuff. After that, I never knew this. Now, they sold AMO t-shirts, AMO hats, AMO gloves, bracelets, sweaters. The team, the football team, had AMO on their jerseys, and they would, the marching band would spell AMO, A-H-M-O. And the freshmen, sophomores, seniors, juniors and seniors, if they could get somebody to hold up an AMO sign, like a Nobel Prize winner, an actor or somebody, that they would get so many points and stuff like that to go on a field trip.
Right.
Anyhow, I don't know any of this. 38 years go by, and a woman who was teaching at that high school, they brought back the coach to do some classes. The coach had long since retired, but one of the teachers there had gone to my high school back in Illinois. I didn't know her. She didn't know me, but she knew that I'd gone to that school. They interviewed this coach, and they said, where did you ever get that idea, AMO? He said, I'm watching the Dean Martin roast one night, and there's this comedian, Tom Dreesen, and he did that joke, AMO, and I thought that would be a good battle cry. Well, anyhow, 38 years went by, and again, they've been selling stuff for years, sweaters, and I knew nothing about all this. But when I found out about it, the teacher called me. I got all the footage and everything. I took it on the David Letterman show and showed it on Letterman, the marching band and everything. Then I went down there for their homecoming game, and I spoke to the students and met the coach and all that. His name was Schaefer, you know, Wylie, Texas, and a wonderful man. And anyhow, I say to you, of all the jokes I've written, that would probably not be the... I would never thought that joke would have any impact on anybody anywhere, you know.
Unbelievable. They should erect a statue of you in front of the school. That's what they should do.
No, that's very nice, but I don't think they'll do that. But you never know. The moral of that story is you never know as a public speaker or as any human being in life how you might affect someone else's life.
That's true.
Just with you know, a kind gesture. I think it was Mitch Albom wrote a book called The Five People You Meet in Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fascinating book that this person died and went to heaven. And the five people he doesn't even remember meeting.
Right.
But he did something one morning here and a little gesture there that made that person do something, and it made another person do something, and so you never know. You never know that a smile, you might be walking down the street and somebody's forlorn and you smile at them and say good morning. And it changes their day, and they do something that they, because of that, that does something that because of that. And you never know. It just travels. And so you just never know what you're here for, but we're all here for some purpose.
I agree. And we're all connected somehow, you know?
I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, Einstein said, you cannot destroy energy, it just changes form.
Exactly.
So, you know, if you're an atheist, you know, if you don't believe in the hereafter, I do. I believe in God, and I believe in all that. But even if you're an atheist, Einstein said you can't destroy energy; it just changes form. So the body will die, but your spirit, your energy. What I'm talking to you right now is an energy coming out of my body.
Right.
That has to go somewhere. You know, the body will die, the cadaver.
Right.
You know, but your energy must go somewhere. So I think maybe we just go out into space and we just drift around and come back more until we make it right, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I was a top 40 DJ back in the late 70s, so of course WKRP was one of my favorite TV shows. And you're the second guy from that show I've interviewed. The other guy was Michael DeBar, who was on an episode called Hoodlum Rock, Scum of the Earth. He was in that band, Scum of the Earth, and his character was Dog, which was another funny episode. But you are Rick Japerson, and you and Venus Flytrap, Tim Reed, got together again on this show, which was incredible. And that's one of my favorite episodes, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you very much. You know what? That was a wonderful reunion. So the people listening to you understand, Tim Reed and I were America's first black and
That's
white
right.
comedy team. History shows we were the last.
Mm-hmm.
In 1969 to 1975, we toured the nation as the first black-white comedy team. There were no comedy clubs in those days. So we worked all black clubs in the North and the South and all white clubs. You know, all black clubs affectionately were called the Chitlin Circuit, black
right. home,
black-operated nightclubs. The 20 grand in Detroit, the High Chaparral in Chicago, the Burning Spear in Chicago, the Sugar Shack in Boston, the Club Harlem in Atlantic City before they had gambling.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, you know, we took on the wrath of America. America was in heavy turmoil at that time. The Vietnam War was raging. I had just gotten out of the service.
Yeah.
Tim just got out of college. And there were race riots all over America, in
sure.
Philadelphia and New York and Watts and Compton and in Chicago and in my neighborhood where I grew up at, one of the largest riots in the country.
Yeah.
And amidst all that, we were going around trying to make people laugh. You know, I always say, you know, we always thought if we could just get people to sit down and laugh together, maybe they could live together, you know. We weren't like preaching or anything like that. We were just two guys who really liked one another. We were good buddies.
Right.
And he had a wife and two kids. I had a wife and three kids. And we were out there trying to make a living, making people laugh. And we paid dues. And the fourth time on stage, a guy put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face.
Oh, my God.
And tried to beat the hell out of me. And yeah. I boxed him. I was in the service, but he outweighed me by 100 pounds. You know, a year later, University of Illinois, a guy hit me in the face with an ice ball, you know, went out and packed an ice ball in the snow and came in and threw it on the stage and hit me in the face. Now, most people love what we did.
Right.
But in those days, racism was very strange in those days. But there was a black guy who hated white people, hated them with a passion.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Tim for being with me.
Right.
You know, Tim would be an Uncle Tom in his mind.
Right.
If there was a white guy who hated black people with a passion, he wasn't mad at Tim. He was mad at me. See, I was the N-word lover, and they didn't mind.
Right.
Two, three of them got me down in the bathroom down in Atlanta trying to do a number on me, you know. But it wasn't often. It was just a small percentage.
Right.
But we paid dues that no other
sure.
comedy team ever had to pay. And we had laughs and fun and were the best of friends to this day. His children call me Uncle Tom, which is really funny in itself, you know. And my children love him and I love his children and we're the best of friends.
Yeah, I love Tim.
We wrote a book called Tim and Tom.
Yes.
An American Comedy in Black and White.
You sure did.
You can get it on Amazon now. But the book sold well and now we've got a script and we're trying to make a movie out of it.
Yeah, I heard about that. That's left on your bucket list, right?
Yes, it is.
The movie. Yeah, that'd be great. Good luck on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Tom, what's your handicap in golf?
Well, I'm about a 7 now, but
wow.
I was a 3 and then a 4 and a 5, but you know, it goes up and down, it fluctuates, and especially in the wintertime, my handicap will always go up for some reason. It's colder and tougher to play, you know.
Right.
But I don't get to play as much as I used to, although I just played in the AT&T, you know. I played in the Bob Hope Classic for years. I played in the AT&T. I played in the Frank Sinatra golf tournament for 29 years. I was the master of ceremonies and played in it. And years ago, I was one of the founders with some other fellas on a tour called the Celebrity Players Tour.
Mm-hmm.
It's basketball, baseball, football, hockey, tennis, and show business people who are 10 handicap or below. So it was Johnny Bench, Mike Schmidt, Mario Lemieux, John Elway, Dan Marino, Michael Jordan.
Awesome.
We had 42 Hall of Famers.
Wow.
In show business, we had Jack Wagner, we had Eddie Marinaro, Smokey Robinson, Frankie Avalon, Matt Lauer, Brian Gumbel, myself, different show business people. And we had paid. We were a corporate hospitality entertainment tour. We did 10 to 12 cities a year. And then Rick Roden, a former baseball player, won like $2 million on our tour, you know.
Mm.
But it was a fun tour for me and a lot of fun years. Let me digress for a moment, Ray. When I was a little boy, Shining Shoes and Bars.
Right.
And hearing Frank Sinatra sing Come Fly With Me. And then years later, I was flying with him all over the world.
Yeah.
When I was a little boy, you know, I'm a sports fan. I played football. I played basketball, baseball. If you ever told me that one day, Tom, you're going to fly all over the world with Frank Sinatra, I said, that's impossible.
Yeah.
That you were going to stay in his home and be a pallbearer at his funeral, because I never thought about being in show business. That was impossible. If you said one day you're going to get inside of an arena and you're going to compete against the greatest athletes who lived in your lifetime, I'd say, now I know that's impossible.
Yeah.
But that's what I did on this tour. I would get into an arena and we'd play golf against one another.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really, you know, if I die tomorrow, the world doesn't owe me a thing. I really, really have it. I said in our book, in Tim and Thomas' book, it's like God said to me, the first half of your life, I'm going to put a load on you. But if you survive, the second half is on me. And the second half has been on God.
Yeah.
Thank you, God.
My aunt used to tell me, you know, God may twist your neck, but he won't kill you. You know? That's what she told me.
I never heard that.
Yeah.
One of my mom had a plaque in her kitchen saying that the talent you have is God's gift to you. What you do with that talent is your gift to God.
Right, exactly.
And that's my thing about Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra sang his songs and millions of dollars were raised and they built Protestant orphanages and he's not Protestant. He sang his songs and millions of dollars were raised and they built they sent thousands of African American children to college,
mm-hmm.
and certainly he's not African American.
Right.
He sang his songs and millions of dollars were raised, and they built Jewish temples, and he's not Jewish.
That's right.
You know, so if it's true that the talent you have is God's gift to you, but what you do with that talent is your gift to God, I know of no one in our industry that ever did more for their God than Frank Sinatra.
I agree. Yep. He just didn't publicize it. You know, there's so much he did, and we won't know about it.
And why he didn't publicize it? Because he didn't want anyone to know.
Right.
And that's part of it. If any of your listeners get a chance, there's a book called The Magnificent Obsession by Lloyd C. Douglas.
Okay.
Its predecessor was a book called Dr. Hudson's Secret Journal. And in it is a secret of success. If you want to succeed in any endeavor, once you ask your master,
mm-hmm.
and it goes on to the biblical phrase, ask and you shall receive.
Right.
If you really want to be a comedian or whatever it is you want, and you pray for it and you ask your master, then you have to believe with all your heart that you ask and you shall receive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, if you believe that, then you have to keep your eyes and ears open for his less fortunate children.
Right.
And try to help them with, if you're an accountant, if you're a bricklayer or a singer, whatever it is, if you see his less fortunate children, you have to try to help them in some way and they not know it. And try to help them privately and quietly so that they don't know that you helped them. If you do that, within 30 days, your master will reward you towards your endeavor. And again, that's biblical. It's something about shouting or tooting your horn in front of the temple or something like that.
Right.
And Frank believed that and lived that, you know, and he did things, so many things anonymously, you know.
He did that to his grave. I mean, like I said, his gravestone is very small and very humble, you know, for a man of his magnitude. It's amazing. And
that's what he wanted. He once told me, we were coming out of Waldorf Astoria one night on our way to do a show. And they rushed him out the back. He couldn't go out the front. People would mob him. So he was being rushed out the back. He had a backup apartment in the back of the Waldorf Astoria. And the security was rushing us to the limo. And there was a woman jumped out of the doorway. And the doorman told me she had been there for 5 hours waiting. She jumped out the door and said, screaming, Mr. Sinatra, please, Mr. Sinatra, please, please, Mr. Sinatra. And the security guards grabbed her. And Frank was getting the limo. But she kept yelling. He turned around and he went back. He said, what is it? She said, if I could get an autograph for my husband, he's home ill.
Right.
It would mean the world to him if you would just sign an autograph. He's so ill. And Frank said, sure. And he signed in the autograph. She said, oh, what beautiful cufflinks those are. And they were $2,000 cufflinks. I know where he got them at. And he said, thank you. And he signed the autograph and he took the cufflinks off and he handed it to her. He said, give these to your husband. She said, oh, no. I didn't want them. I just was admiring them. He said, no, I want your husband to have them. We get in the car. And I said to him, Frank, that was beautiful, but, you know, why did you do that? He said, Tommy, if you possess something that you can't give away, then you don't possess it. It possesses you.
Right. It's true.
And,
Very true.
He said, it's okay if somebody says to you, gee, I love your Mercedes-Benz, and you don't give it to them.
Yeah.
But when you're in the mirror shaving, mm-hmm. when you're looking at that guy in the mirror, you got to admit to that guy in the mirror, that car owns you,
because mm-hmm.
you can't give it away.
Right.
Because it owns you. Now, he didn't only talk that talk, he walked that talk. you couldn't say to Frank Sinatra, gee, that's a nice jacket. He'd give it to you.
Huh.
You couldn't say, gee, what a beautiful painting on the wall. He'd take it off the wall and hand it to you.
Mm-hmm.
His friends had to be very careful around him, not to mention they wanted something. You know, because he was that kind. He told me once, he said, Tom, you know, Aristotle Onassis was a multi-billionaire. The second he died, it all transferred. It
yeah.
was not his yacht.
Right.
It was
right.
not his private
exactly.
jet. It was not his mansion.
Yep.
The second he died, it transferred. We're only using it, Tommy.
That's right.
The money you have in your pocket, the shirt on your back. The second you die, it transfers.
Yeah.
So enjoy it. And by the way, he did.
Yeah. He sure did. Where were you when the Cubs won the World Series?
I was in at the Marriott Hotel.
Uh-huh.
Frank and I did our last show. I was doing a corporate date down there.
Right.
Corporation, and I went to the three World Series games at Wrigley Field. I went back there
right.
with my road manager one night, my nephew one night, and Gary Sinise one night. We, you know, he's a Chicago guy too. I went three nights in a row because I couldn't miss a World Series at Wrigley Field in my lifetime, you know. And then when I had this gig down there, luckily I got off stage in time that I could go to my suite down there and watch the game on TV. I was all alone. And when they won that game after that little bit of rain delay,
mm-hmm.
I make my living for 50 years. This is my 50th year in show business. I make my living talking. I could not talk. Ray, I honestly could not talk. I was speechless. My daughter called me, and I was so choked up. My phone was ringing because people all over the country were
coming. Yeah.
But I couldn't speak. I walked the room, and I said, oh, my God, it's over. It's over.
Can you believe
it? All the joking and all the razzing and all the years that we almost
yeah.
got there and all the times. And because I'm such a sports fan, you know,
yep, me too.
In my lifetime, it finally happened.
Yeah.
It happened. And I wanted to do like almost every Cup fan in America wanted to do. I wanted to go to the graves of all those people,
right.
your dad and your family and
right.
your uncles and your friends and your buddies that were Cup fans that were no longer in, and say to them, they did it, man.
Yeah.
They did it, you know, lay a wreath down there or something. You know.
Yeah.
It was an incredible moment in my life.
And you did it with our manager. Tampa
yeah, that's
Bay.
Right. That's right.
That's right, Madden.
I've met him several times. He's a good guy.
He is a good guy. I met him too. Real good guy.
Yeah.
You think he's going to be around much longer, or they've been talking
well,
about?
I think they have an option. His 2020 contract. You know, they haven't. I mean, they haven't gone after it yet. And I think it depends on this year. You know, everybody in the division the Cubs are in boosted. Everybody got somebody. The
yeah.
Cubs hardly made any changes at all.
Yeah.
So they're going to have to win with what they got. Meanwhile, the other teams are up to their standards now. And you know, and I know, it's about pitching, and it's about that bullpen too.
That's right.
And if that doesn't hold up, I'm sorry. You know.
Yeah.
They got a great ball club though. They meet it with Baez and Bryant and Rizzo. And I mean, this kid, Amora Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And Schwarber. I mean, they got the nucleus of a great team, you know, and they got some good pitching, but, they're going to all have to step up it's a tough division.
I was born in Baltimore, so I've been an Oriole fan from way back. I always wanted to see an Orioles Cubs World Series. I always thought that would be good. You know,
that would be an interesting. I was a Cal Ripken fan, of course,
yep.
like you were, I'm
yeah.
sure. You know,
yeah, I go back to Brooks, Frank, and Boog Powell, and Dave McNally, and you know, Frank Robinson just passed away. That really hurt me.
That's right.
One of my heroes. Yeah.
You know, somebody told me Don Newcomb. Did Don Newcomb die today?
I haven't heard that.
Yeah. I met him many times out here. He was a phenomenal pitcher. And then also spent 2 years in Korea, you know.
Right.
In the Korean War, you know.
You know what's sad was the Ron Santos story. He really suffered at the end, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He had diabetes.
Yeah.
He was a good friend, too. He really was a good friend.
He was great. I love that Cub team, you know, with Ernie Banks and Santo.
By the way, they lost 12 out of their last 13 games. They were six games in front.
Right.
And lost 12 out of the last 13 games, and they called them the Amazing Mets one that year in 69. But it was just the Cubs faltered so bad, and they
yeah.
had such a great ball club that year. Great pitching, you know.
Great pitching, yeah. Tom, I watched a YouTube video. I don't know. I didn't know how to take this, if it was a promo or what. You did the evening variety talk show called Nighttime for Chicago TV. And yeah. You were saying that, well, you know, Dean Martin's been ill and he's not going to show up. Frank was supposed to be here. Sammy was supposed to be here. And then the audience was acting like they were leaving. But you said, but we've got Spuds McKenzie. And then everybody came back to their seats. What was that all about?
That was all a bit. It was part of the bit.
Okay.
So what happened was Frank, Sammy, and Dean occurring, and they were at the Chicago Theater.
Right.
I was doing a show called a sub for 1 week. Oprah Winfrey was on the road. I was on hiatus, and they let me have her studio. ABC, a guy named Joe Ahern was head of ABC in Chicago.
Right.
And ABC TV was right across the street from the Chicago Theater, where Frank, Sammy, and Dean were doing the tour, the latter tour. And Dean got really angry. They said he got sick, but he wasn't. Him and Frank had a falling out. And Dean went back to L.A. that night. But the Monday, they were supposed to do my show and then go to New York the next day. Frank, Sammy, and Dean were all going to come on my show and be my first guest.
Mm-hmm.
So we put all the promos out. You know, be my first guest, my first night. I was going to only have my show for 1 week. And anyhow, as it turns out, when Dean got mad and went back to the West Coast, they went into New York to get Liza Minnelli and to rehearse the show with her. So they had to go into New York right away. And Barbara Sinatra and Altavies subbed for me.
Right.
You know, they subbed for Frank and Sammy and Dean. You know, it would have been so much fun having those three guys on the show.
Oh, yeah. I love it when Johnny Carson, when, you know, Dean Martin just shows up, and sometimes Frank and Dean will show up. I saw one of the episodes where Joey Bishop was the guest hosts, and they pop out in their tuxedos, and those were the days, man.
Yeah, they really were, and I got in on the tail end of it, and Ray, in the 14 years I toured with Frank Sinatra, I turned down more sitcoms than most comedians get offered in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Because every time they came to me, it would mean that I had to quit touring with Frank and flying all over the world with Frank Sinatra, and then quit playing golf on the Celebrity Players Tour, you know, which here I was with all my heroes, you know, competing against them and flying with Frank Sinatra all over the world. And I remember Christopher Morley, the author, once said, success is living the life you want.
Right, exactly.
And
yeah.
I'm a neighborhood guy. I'm a guy from the neighborhood.
Right.
I don't have a degree from academia. I got a doctorate from the streets. I grew up on the streets, shining shoes in taverns, setting pins in bowling alleys, caddying in the summer, you know, selling newspapers on the corner to help feed my brothers and sisters.
Sure.
You know, because we came from a real poor family. Then I came out of the service 4 years in the military. Now I'm a bartender, and I'm hanging out in the bars in the corner of saloons, you know. Like Frank said, I was a saloon comedian. He was a saloon singer, you know. And this is what a street kid dreams of. That you're going to be flying all over the world with Frank Sinatra, and you're going to be you know, playing golf, competing against the greatest athletes of your time. And so, but if you got this show, you'd have to give all that up. Now, would I have been far more, you know, I've been way more famous and been a star today, but none of that means anything to me, or the money, because Frank taught me all that, you know, because in the end, all you have are memories. That's what all you have in the end. Nobody on their deathbed ever said, gosh, I wish I would have worked more.
Yeah.
So all you have are memories. So I made some great memories.
Yes, you did.
I got some great memories. You know,
With all the gigs you had, you either had a phenomenal publicist or just a lot of friends.
Well, I'll be honest with you, when I started doing The Tonight Show, before I did my first appearance on The Tonight Show, I was on my butt. I had a wife and three kids living in a little tiny apartment that I could hardly even pay the rent. And I was on unemployment. I was on my rear end. And that first Tonight Show, my whole life turned around. I never stopped working from that first day. So I was doing, like I say, Johnny Carson, Mike Douglas, Merv Griffin, you know, Dinah Shore. Now, in order to get on those shows in those days, you had to work clean. They didn't have cable television in those days, so you had to work clean. You had to do the right material that could make grandma and grandpa, mom and dad and the kids laugh. So a lot of artists wanted me to tour with them because I wouldn't offend their, you know, I toured with Tony Orlando and Dawn. I toured with Mac Davis. I toured with Smokey Robinson. I toured with Gladys Knight and the Pips. I toured with Natalie Cole. Frankie Avalon and I did tours together. James Darren, you know, all these, Frankie Valli, these are friends of mine that, you know, they knew that the agents used to call it a SAFE Act.
Right.
You know, that you weren't going to go on, and like corporations. In those days, you know, If people come to your nightclub show, they're at the mercy of your material. But if corporate America hires you, you know, then they can dictate policy and say, look, my wife's a born again, or there's an all Jewish audience and the rabbi is going to be there.
Right.
You know, they wanted material that could make, you know, that were clean. So I was fortunate that I had enough material like that that I could do that, you know.
But you're a good guy, man. That's why all these good things happen to you. Another guy I've had on my show and I keep in contact with is Rich Little. He's another good guy. You know, he's been like that all his life too. He's been, you know, clean and humble and, you know, had a lot of gigs and stuff. We talked about the Dean Martin celebrity roast and how there's really nobody left. You know, everybody's
right.
Gone.
You know, Rich, they just honored him here at some award I had gotten the year before, and they honored Rich at the Pioneer Broadcasters Association or something like that. And I went there and was on the dais with Rich, and he's right. I'm trying to think if there's only a few people left who did the Dean Martin roast. Ruth Buzzi is
Ruth
one.
Buzzi.
Of course, she's still alive down in Texas.
Yeah.
Her and her husband, Kent, are good friends of mine.
Yeah.
And Ruth and Rich and myself, but there's not a lot that are still with us, you know.
It's amazing. We talk hockey. He's a hockey fan, of course, from Canada. And he was rooting for Vegas, and I'm a big Washington Capitals fan. So I kind of feel, you know, not as harsh as the Cubs not winning all those years, but the Capitals did not, you know, win for like 40-some years since their inception. So I kind of understand a little bit what you went through.
And I always said there are less suicides among Cub fans than any other baseball fan because, see, each year we had one more year. Well, maybe it'll be this year. Maybe next year. I was afraid when the Cubs won the World Series that the following day 20,000 people would jump off the top of the Tribune Tower in Chicago because what's there to live for if they won the World Series, you know?
I love Chicago. I've been there several times, you know. I've been at conventions. I owned a dry cleaning business at one time and went to McCormick Place and
I performed there at the Erie Crown Theater with Frank. The first time I ever went to Chicago with Frank was the Erie Crown Theater. We went there every year to a different theater every year. But Chicago, in my opinion, from April to November, is the greatest city in America.
It is.
From April to November. It's a great walking city.
Yep.
It's for culture and for art, the art institutes and all that stuff. For restaurants, they can compete with anybody. The sports, the town, it's a great sports town with two Major League Baseball teams and the Bears, the Blackhawks, you know, but the bottom line are the people are really friendly people, Chicago people, you know, the Midwestern type people, you know.
They are good people. Tom, I want to thank you for all the philanthropy you've done over the years, man. You've done so much. You've done for MS research. You do a thing, too, that I was really impressed when you talk about the fatherless children with dads not being around. I was pretty touched when you were talking about that.
Well, my charity for years is multiple sclerosis because my sister Darlene had MS, and she ultimately passed from complications thereof.
I'm sorry to hear that.
She was my sister. She was 18 months older than me, and I adored her. She was like a mom to me. She was just such a great girl, a wonderful girl. We went to church 6 days a week, and she just was a wonderful one. And she was stricken with MS when she was 24, and none of us knew what it was. And it took her from a cane to a walker to a wheelchair to finally bedridden. And I used to run 26 miles every year and call it 26 miles for Darlene, and people would pledge money for every mile I run.
Right.
And then it would go to research, you know, and helping me. All the celebrities, my buddies would come in and run, you know, Frankie Avalon and James Darren and Frankie Valli and Tony Danza and Eddie Marinaro and Smokey Robinson and God, so many, I'm leaving people out, but Betty Thomas from Hill Street Blues. Anyhow, Smokey's the only one who ran all 26 miles with me. You know, the other guys would run a mile or two or something, but Smokey ran all 26 miles with me. And anyhow, so then as years went by, I raised a lot of money for them, but then I got involved with Illinois Fatherhood Initiative because I really believe that America cannot be destroyed from without. Obviously, we're one of the strongest military, if not the strongest military ever existed on the planet.
Right.
Our enemies from without, I don't think will ever defeat us, but from within, is the breakdown of the family structure.
Yeah. Right.
Now, the number one, 77% of all teenage crimes are created by fatherless teenagers, are committed by fatherless teenagers. Mm-hmm. You know, 77%. This year, 75% of the children being born in Detroit are being born without a father in the home. 3 out of every 10 white families in America, 3 out of every 10 white children born in America are born without a father in the home. 5 out of every 10 Hispanic and 7 out of every 10 African American with no father in the home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was growing up in my neighborhood in Chicago, in the Chicagoland area, in the Irish neighborhood, the Polish neighborhood, the Italian neighborhood, the Jewish neighborhood, the African American neighborhood, any one of those neighborhoods when I was growing up, in 1960, for an example, in Harvey, where I grew up at, 4% of the children were being born without a father in the home. Mm-hmm. Today, 71% are being born without a father in the home.
Wow, you're kidding.
So, when I was growing up, if you said, my mother, when I was 13 years old, said, if you get a girl pregnant, you'll stand by her.
Right.
That was the mantra in every one of those neighbors, the Irish neighbor, the Italian neighbor,
sure,
the Polish neighbor. If you get a girl pregnant, you'll stand by her. And if you didn't, the men of that neighborhood would come to you and say, hey, you're going to marry that girl. And you say, no, I'm not going to marry her. They say, well, okay, then you're going to support the child, because if you don't, we have to.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1964, well-intentioned but misinformed, the war on poverty, if you have one baby out of wedlock, you get $250 or whatever the number was. If you have two babies out of wedlock with two different men, that's $500. Three babies out of wedlock, that's $750. But three different men. And by the way, if one of those men were living with you, you do not get those benefits. So, you know, while they meant well, they destroyed those communities.
Yeah.
Because when I was growing up, the men and the boys in our neighborhood were far more afraid of their fathers than they were the police.
Definitely.
You know, and so the men of the neighborhood policed their own neighborhoods. If there was a young thug in a Polish neighborhood or an Irish neighborhood or African-American neighborhood roaming the streets snatching purses and robbing money, the men of that community went out and got him and took him home to his father.
Right.
You know, and today there aren't all the murders in Chicago that they're talking about.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science to me.
Right.
Oh, why is this happening? Why it's happening? There are no men in the community. You got a grandmother who's got 4 little grandchildren
right,
trying to take care of them, keep them away from the gangs.
Right.
Not the mother of the children. The mother sometimes is in jail or in problems with drugs. The grandmother's watching these 4 children. She's trying to keep them away from the gangs, and she's got a broomstick, and the gang's got an AK-47.
Yeah.
Who's going to win that fight?
Yeah.
You know, so it's not rocket science, and that's why that's my charity, the Illinois Fathered Initiative, to bring awareness to what will destroy our nation. What will destroy our nation is the breakdown of the family structure, and that's my soapbox. I'm sorry, Ray, I went too long with that.
No. Like you said, men cease to be men, you know, which I agree 100%. To me, the men have declined, you know, as far as the men aren't the man's man anymore like they used to be. There still are. But, you know, not like the younger generation aren't like that, like we grew up, you know, I still take care of my dad. He's 94 years old. He was a Marine, you know, served in World War II, you know, very proud of that.
Oh, God bless him.
You know, but, yeah, I agree with you 100%. I mean, what else can we do? I mean, like Big Brothers, would that help, you know, get more involved with these kids if we can help do things like that?
Again, you know, again, it's so hard to describe, you know, for those who didn't have a father in the home.
Yeah.
You know, by the way, are there women who have raised their children to keep them? Yes.
Right.
There's some very strong women. But even I've met guys, and I think it was, oh God, was it 50 Cent? One of the rappers
mm-hmm.
said that all I've accomplished is great, but I'm not the man I could be if I'd only had a father in the home.
Right.
I had a good mom, and she did the best we could, but
right,
I didn't have a father role model, and I wish I could have. He said, I think I could have been a better man today.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
You need that sort of role model in your home. You can give me success stories of people who didn't have a father in the home, and I understand that. That's true. That does happen. But for the most part, when I tell you that 77% of all teenage crimes are created by fatherless teenagers, that ought to tell you something, you know.
Yeah.
And by the way, I want to do something real quick.
Sure.
About your dad.
Okay.
I will let, I'm an ex-GI, but right, I will let people argue with me if they want about wars. You know, there are sometimes people say that, you know, war was wrong or this. I will let you argue with me about a few things. I will not let you argue with me about World War II. There was no doubt about what Tojo and Hitler had in mind for this
right,
country. You know, the men and women of that community, Tom Brokaw was right. They were the greatest generation. And men like your dad, that, you know, at 17 years old, and Artie Murphy went in the Army at age 16.
Yeah.
At age 16, by the time he was 17, he was in mortal combat. Before he was 19, he received the Medal of Honor. The most decorated soldier in all of World War II. Those people in Normandy and Iwo Jima and Guadalcanal and the Battle of Midway, without those men and women that served, we would all be in some sort of under dictatorship or in the concentration camps. You know, so I won't let you argue with me about World War II, nor will I let you argue with me about Korea. If you want to know the difference between capitalism and you want to know the difference between communism and capitalism, look at South Korea and North Korea.
Yep, definitely.
One is a thriving country, and the other, you see what North Korea is. That's what the difference between capitalism and communism.
Right.
You know, and men like your father, and by the way, they're dying at 1,100 a day now.
They are.
Soon we won't have any World War II veterans
left
on this planet. God bless them all. Yeah. By the way, there's a great song that was written by a Dr. Bierstock from Florida, not far from you,
mm-hmm.
and Sam Bierstock, B-I-E-R-S-T-O-C-K.
Right.
And it's a song is called Before You Go. Downloaded. It's been downloaded about 100 million times. And Ray, I hope your father lives to be 105. But when he passes, I want you to play that song mm-hmm. at your father's funeral.
Okay.
It's called Before You Go. Download it tonight if you haven't got it, Ray.
Okay.
It's called Before You Go.
Before You Go.
And it's a World War II song. And the lyrics, what happened was this doctor was leaving the hospital one day. And he had his top down or something. And he stopped at a stop sign. There was an old man picking up rags and bottles. And he said to him, "How you doing?" And the old guy looked at him and he said, "How am I doing? I took two bullets in my body in World War II, and I'm picking up rags and bottles. That's how I'm doing." And Dr. Sam said, "See, I drove away." And he thought about it, and he turned around and he came back, and he got out of the car, and he shook his hand. He said, "Thank you. Thank you for your service.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your service to our country." And he went home and he wrote this song, Before You Go. And I ask anybody to download it. If this doesn't choke you up, nothing will. You know?
Yeah, I've got it up now on the internet.
There you go.
Yeah, the Veterans Tribute. Yep. Is that the Buddy Brown?
I think he's singing it, and Sam Bierstock wrote it.
Sam, okay. All right.
It's Before You Go, and there's a version for the Vietnam veterans as well, but look for the World War II version of it, and you'll see what I mean. You know, it's a dedication. You know, because without that nation, there would be no Miami Dolphins. There would be no Chicago Cubs, or no Washington Nationals. There would be no. There wouldn't be those things as we know it. You know, but you'll see that in the video and in the song. You know?
Yeah, I've got it up now. I got the website and. Yeah, I'll mention that on the show as well as a closing, so everybody can go to that. Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, my brother went to Vietnam. He was in the Air Force, and I was the only one that didn't serve because there was no draft. But I wanted to join the Navy actually on the buddy system.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and I was actually talked out of it by two Navy SEALs.
I'll be done.
Yeah, they were in Hawaii, you know, and I don't know. I don't know what happened, but
I went in on the buddy plan with two guys from my neighborhood.
Did you?
Yeah, I served on the USS Tarawa and the USS Essex aircraft carriers, and I served with a Marine Corps unit for 9 months called NEGDF, Naval Emergency Ground Defense Force, and I don't regret. And to this day, I always do show for the troops. I'm an ambassador on the Gary Sinise Foundation.
Right.
Gary, what we do, we raise money to build homes, smart homes, for our disabled, the GIs, men and women who end up losing a leg or an arm. And so, you know, we raise money to build smart homes for them. And Gary Sinise is probably the greatest American patriot I've ever met in my life, you know, including Bob Hope.
You went to Iraq, right? Didn't you perform for the troops?
Yeah, with the troops there. Well, and because I remember when I was in the service, if somebody would come and play harmonica, we thought that was pretty cool, you know. And so entertainers, you know. And of course, I worked with Bob Hope, you know. You know, a lot of times did shows with Bob, and I always admired what he did for our kids.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, for example, your dad in World War II, and that, again, that's before my time, but, you know, Bob Bob Hope was a big star. He was on every radio show and all, I mean, all these, and a big star. So he would go to these islands and hear these guys would, there's Bob Hope in the middle of this jungle where they are. And it somehow he brought home to them because they were used to laying on the living room floor with their mom and their dad sitting in a chair and they were listening to Bob Hope. And now they were over in some island in the Pacific and there's Bob Hope. So how much does it mean to have people from America come and perform for you and tell you how much they appreciate your service, you know?
He'd be performing and you'd hear enemy fire, you know, in the background, you know, that was something. Bob Hope was a great man. He really was. He's done a lot for this country.
Well, and so is your dad. Again, it's your dad. It's people like your dad, you know, that kept us free. And freedom and patriotism isn't something that you're born with. Every generation has to renew that faith in your country.
Right.
That's why I loved when I was a kid saying the Pledge of Allegiance and things like that.
Yeah.
I know I sound corny and old school to some people probably listening to you, but that's just the way that we were raised. This great pride in this nation of ours. Did America make mistakes? Oh my God. Of course they did. There were so many terrible things. Slavery being one.
Yeah.
You know, one thing you should know as an Italian, that Italians were lynched in villages all over in this country in 11 at a time, and they burned out Italian villages in Pennsylvania, in Frankfort, Illinois, not far from where I was raised. There were many Italians lynched. This nation made some mistakes, you know, many mistakes, but they also rectified them. And so that you know that during World War II, more Italian Americans fought were in the service than any other ethnicity in America.
Yep.
Italians. The first Medal of Honor recipient was Bassiglione from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Bassiglione. And he received the Medal of Honor, came out of the Marine Corps, and went back in the Marine Corps and did as many extraordinary things in combat that were greater than what he received the Medal of Honor for, and he was killed in the line of duty there. So I'm just saying, of all the mistakes America's made, remember the same people rectified those mistakes.
Right.
You know, yes, there were dumb things in America, but you don't have to keep beating that drum. Because, like the Italians in my family, I never heard those stories about Italians being lynched and burned out of villages because they didn't speak the kind of language that everybody else spoke and there was prejudice against the Italians. I never knew that. I heard stories about Irish do not apply and all that stuff. But what it is we assimilated and we moved on.
Mm-hmm.
We became Americans and we moved on.
You know, it's amazing. After winning the war, say in Japan and even in Vietnam, those cities are built up. It's almost like they won the war. You know what I mean?
But again, that's what capitalism is all about.
Right.
Again, look at South Korea.
Yep.
Ask the South Koreans. Were they glad that our boys went over there and fought, our men and women?
Hell,
there's 58,000 men who died in that war, in Korean War or something. You know, are they honored by South Koreans? Ask the South Koreans that story. Because if they weren't living in the economy they're living in, they'd be in North Korea.
Yep.
You know, and look how that economy is. So that's what, capitalism has its faults. I think it was Winston Churchill or somebody said, you know, that democracy is the worst form of government ever written. However, there's none better.
I was surprised how much Vietnam got built up, you know?
Yeah. And by the way,
but that's a good thing.
That they've become very capitalist.
Yes, they have.
Very capitalist.
They have. But the good thing is there's no communism. They're more like us now, you know? And it's peaceful. And so we've accomplished what we wanted to do, I guess, you know? Got the bad guy.
You live in a society where you're told what to say.
Yeah.
Or you're punished for what you're saying.
Right.
You know, you're in the wrong society.
Yep.
You know, the First Amendment, you know, millions of men in the politically correct police in America today bore me to death.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we don't know who you are. We don't know. We know who the Republicans are, who the Democrats are, the Independents are. We know who the Kiwanis, the Moose, the Elks. We know who the Ku Klux Klan is, but we don't know who you are. And you keep telling us what we can say and what we can't say. You know, and again, you know, if you don't like what someone is saying, don't listen to them, turn them off, walk away.
Right.
But you can't stop them from saying fire, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater.
Right.
Either, you know.
I've got a book out, Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C. It's about growing up in the family business in D.C. since I was a kid. And we, you know, we did all kinds of things that were not politically correct, and I was proud of it.
That's great. What's the name of the book?
There's two. Wacky Shenanigans on F Street. That's one of them. And the other one's called Check the G's. There's actually a trailer on YouTube. If you punch in Check the G's with my name in it, you'll see the trailer, the movie trailer.
Well, I'll look at that for sure.
Yeah. You like the book. I'll send it to you. It's funny.
Please do.
You'll like it. Todd, first of all, thank you for your service, man. I forgot to say that earlier. Thank you for your military service. And do you have anything else you'd like to add or promote?
No. You can go to my website, TomDreesen.com. D as in David, yep. R-E-E-S-E-N. Everybody spells my name wrong, but it's D-R-E-E-S-E-N, three E's and one S.
Right.
Dreesen.com. And you can find, there's all kinds of stuff on YouTube and videos I've done and just shenanigans I've done, you know.
You're all over YouTube, man.
Yeah, that's what somebody tells me. I hate to look at shows I've done in the past.
Right.
I just feel like every day's a new day and that I've grown so much as an artist in the 50 years that when I look back at things I did 45 years ago, I just cringe sometimes, you know, but that's part of what we're all about.
Well, you know, you haven't changed much, man. You look great, you know? You haven't changed that much.
You look wonderful. My hair is a lot grayer, have you noticed? And,
you
know,
well, you can always color that. Tom, what's Amy's, how do you pronounce her last name? Because I want to make sure I thank her properly.
It's my daughter, really.
Oh, that's your daughter?
B-A-R-B-U-S-C-I-A.
Okay.
She, my manager passed away a couple of years ago. My daughter took over that part of it, you know.
And, oh, that's wonderful.
And really, really, you know, I've got two daughters and a son.
Right.
And four grandchildren now, you know. But she's really so efficient, such a good girl.
Oh, great.
Her name is B-A-R-B-U-S-C-I-A, Babusha.
Babusha.
She married another Italian, you know.
Babusha.
She married Italian.
Okay. Yeah, I want to properly thank her as well for setting this up. Tom, thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. More importantly, for all the laughs through the decades. I hope the book becomes a successful movie. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, and I'm also in the process of writing my own book at this time, you know, and hopefully be out by next June.
Oh, good.
But we'll see.
I'll contact Amy, and I'll ask her where to send the book so I can send you a copy of my book.
Okay, please do.
I will. And keep in touch, man. Thank you, Tom.
Take care.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye-bye. Very special thanks to Amy Barbusha of Dreesen Productions, Inc. for arranging this interview with Tom Dreesen. And, of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It is real news, people. For more information about Tom Dreesen, visit www.tomdreesen.com or Tom's on Facebook, www.facebook.com/TomDreesen. You can also purchase Tim and Tom, an American comedy in black and white, with authors by Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen, also Ron Rappaport. That's currently available on Amazon.com. It's a great read. You will love it. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of a Neglected American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com, and I promise you will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio. Station 1.